Hello, I'm Mark Gerson, and I'm the rabbi's husband. Yes, that is the name of the show, and it is also who I am, as the very fortunate spouse of Rabbi Erica Gerson. One of the many benefits of being a rabbi's husband is living in an environment full of love of the Torah, and specifically, love of the Torah as it was intended, as a guidebook to help us live happier, better, and more meaningful lives in the most practical and always actionable ways. That, in fact, is the purpose of this show, to discuss with the most interesting people from a diversity of backgrounds their favorite biblical passage with regards to how it inspires, instructs, enlightens, and directs them in the most practical way. I am delighted today to be joined by Rabbi Sherry Hirsch. Rabbi Hirsch is currently the Chief Innovation Officer of the American Jewish University in Los Angeles. She was previously the Spiritual Director of Hillel and of Canyon Ranch, and before that was a pulpit rabbi at Temple Sinai in Los Angeles. She is the author of two books, which are magnificent, by the way. One is called We Plan, God Laughs, and the other is called Thresholds. Rabbi Hirsch, welcome to The Rabbi's Husband.
Nice to see you, Mark. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, before we get into your chosen passage, which I totally love, it is Leviticus 10:3. You've been involved with being the spiritual director of a variety of organizations.
Yeah, I've been the rabbinic head of Hillel International. I've been the spiritual consultant for Canyon Ranch Properties, which is a bit unexpected. And now I'm the chief innovation officer. So I have a bit of an unusual rabbinic journey.
Right. Now, perhaps because I'm quite far geographically from Los Angeles, I don't really know what spirituality is. And I want to get your response to a definition from Rev Simcha Bunim, who I think was an 18th or 19th century rabbi. And this is what he said. He said, the true definition of a spiritual man is he who always imagines his head lying in a guillotine, his evil inclination above it, ready to chop off his head at a moment's call. So one of his students asked, what if one does not have that feeling? In that case, the rabbi said, his head has been chopped off already.
Wow, I love that story, Mark. So I'm not sure I agree with Rabbi Bunin's interpretation, because that has about a lot of heat lahavu. Like, you have to be super a zealot, like a Pinchas, in order to be spiritual. I would say that spirituality is on a perpetual quest to find God and to live a life informed by Judaism for Jews, and that each day is more possible than the next. So where is God in that for each person? Very different, right? There's 88 names for God in the Bible. There's only 500 words used over and over again. So call God George, call God Fred, call God water. I don't really care. What I do care about is that you are on a perpetual quest to live life better and to leave it better than you got here and than you did the day before.
So as you interpret it, it's not an activity one does necessarily by oneself at all.
Not at all. In fact, the opposite. I would say, you know, we're not Buddhist, we're Jews, and that the spiritual quest is done in community. And almost this meditative philosophy that you're sort of only spiritual when you're sitting like the Buddha with your arms crossed is sort of anti-Jewish, right? We're not that person. We are not meant to be in a cave, isolated, feeling spiritual. And there was a part of me when I was much younger that thought, I'll be spiritual when I can like take everything in with equanimity. And I sort of thought I had to be dispassionate. And I actually don't believe that at all. I think one of the key components of spirituality is passion. And that goes back to the Rabbi Bunin story.
Well, beautiful. You've already educated me and really helped inform the way I now think about spirituality. Let's go from that lesson to another lesson. I love the passage you chose. I think it's one of the most underrated and the most important in the whole Torah. And this is Leviticus 10:3. So Sherry, tell us what happens between Leviticus 10:1 to 10:3, because you can't really do 10:3 without knowing what happens in 1 and 2.
Of course. And let me just say, Mark, when you asked me to pick my favorite passage, I'm sure everyone says it's like asking you to pick your favorite child, but I'm actually one of those people that do have favorites and do have preferences. Do I have a favorite child? I have children that I'm more compatible with. And so I definitely have verses and stories that are more compatible. And this one often brings me to tears. So let me set the stage for you. Aaron has four sons. His two oldest, Nadav and Abihu, are obviously in line to be the head priest. They're enthusiastic. They're passionate. They love their father. They are inspired by their uncle Moshe. And so they bring forth this strange fire, literally, Esh Zara, to offer to God. But God didn't request it, and God didn't want it from them. And then this totally shocking, completely insane incident happens in which a fire from the divine comes forth and consumes them, literally kills them on the spot. I mean, Aaron has dedicated his life to service of this mission. And his two children, his two oldest children, are now just murdered by God. And then what is so powerful is the next line, Vayidom Aharon. And Aaron is Vayidom. And what that Vayidom means and what its implications for and what the rabbis do to try and make sense of it is, to me, one of the most powerful verses in the entire Torah. And I'm looking forward to talking with you about it.
Yeah, so it's translated, and Aaron was silent. So Aaron, as you said, sees his two sons immolated by this divine fire after they brought a strange fire, and then the divine fire consumes them, and then it says Aaron was silent. Is that how you interpret it?
Well, so remember that every translation in English is a translation. That root can mean many things depending on what Hebrew verb you're using, right? Is it in the active tense? Is it in the causative tense? Is it in the past tense? One definition can be that Aaron was silent. And by the way, we have to discuss what silent means. Mm-hmm. A second definition could be that Aaron was still. And you'll hear the rabbis talk about what is stillness. Stillness means he might have been turned to stone. Another definition is die, that he died in that moment. And maybe it's not the death like the physical death of his children, but it's a death. And then a fourth definition was that he was struck dumb, right? The most loquacious, brilliant speaker was struck dumb or speechless. So depending on how you translate that root, Vayidom, lends itself to 100 interpretations and implications for how we understand how we respond to tragedy and how our forefathers responded to tragedy.
Well, very interesting. I keep thinking about what your mentor and my friend David Wolpe always says, which he says that all acts of translation are really interpretation.
Absolutely. And I was with him for 8 years. So it's not surprising that we say a similar thing.
Right. Interesting. So how do you not translate, but how do you interpret Aaron was blank?
Well, so let's just scroll back for a moment. There's a little bit of a other piece of the story you need to know. What happens next is Aaron is Vayidom. We'll go into that. And then Moses says to the community, you are welcome and encouraged to mourn for these two boys. But Aaron, you're forbidden. Now, that is going to inform why Aaron is Vayidom, right? Because Moses basically said, Aaron, you can't mourn. There will be no renting of your clothes, nothing that are the traditional ritual rites you can't do, which, by the way, if you just lost your two children, and we know, Mark, that the death of a child is by far the worst death there is because it is the one that is the most incomprehensible because it is out of order of life. And so there's obvious questions of what was their sin, right? We can talk about that ad nauseum. But the more interesting question is, what does it mean that Aaron was truly silent? Like, did he weep? Was he weeping silently? Was he struck dumb? What happened that he couldn't even now perform these ritual rites? And what was his responsibility? And what was that messaging for us?
Now, do you see insensitivity on Moses's part? Because before we're told that Aaron was silent, or however everyone interprets it, Moses says, I will be sanctified through these, through those who are nearest me, and I will be honored before the entire people. So Moses rushes in with words following this death, but Aaron is silent.
Okay, but what do we know about Moses and Aaron? Moses was chosen to lead the people, and he says, I don't want to do this. I'm not a man of speech. We know he has some speech impediment. And God first speaks to Aaron by saying, you're going to be the spokesman for Moshe and for the people. And we know that Aaron can really speak. I mean, Aaron is not even just loquacious. He's the one that gives the eloquent speeches to Pharaoh. He's the one that gathered everyone and mobilized them to make the golden calf. He's the one that colluded with Miriam, Moses' sister, to gossip about Moses' wife. I mean, Aaron's special power is that he's a talker. So for him to go silent, was that him saying to Moses, I'm done with you? Or was it him saying to God, you tasked me to be the speaker, and what you've done is so beyond the pale, I'm done talking with you. I am going to literally reject you and reject everything that you're about. And my biggest punishment to you is silence. I won't use my superpower.
Very interesting. And I think an amplification of that would be in 10:8, when this is the only time in the Torah when it says Hashem spoke to Aaron. Otherwise, it's always Hashem spoke to Moses and Aaron. This is the only time it says God spoke to Aaron, as though God's putting his arm around him and saying, Aaron, I know, but I'm with you.
Right. And one of the commentators says something really interesting about that, that he told Aaron to keep quiet and I will give you the reward. And the reward is that next time I speak to you, I will speak to you alone and not to Moshe. And that's why you see verse 8. So they're saying the reward of being silent was that you would have special attention. But I like your reading. This was God trying to coach him back into, you got to forgive me. I mean, what I did was beyond the pale. It's vayidom is a very interesting word. It's not vayishtok. Vayishtok, which also means to get quiet or to silence yourself, is very different than vayidom. Vayidom is this internal quietness, like that place of true darkness within you where you are literally without words.
Now, as someone who has been a practicing rabbi for so many years, you must have been with a lot of mourners.
Yeah, more than I could count.
What does your experience as a rabbi teach you about what's going on with Aaron?
So I think there are moments that render us completely without words. You go into a shiva house, and what is the mitzvah? You're supposed to go into a shiva house and not say a word.
And that custom comes from this, right?
That custom comes from the denouement of this, right after this. But what's interesting is there's been people that I've sat with, and in their moment of loss, and remember, loss takes on many forms, Mark, many forms. But in their moment of real loss and tragedy, the best I could do was hold their hand and weep with them. And sometimes weeping was even a form of communication that was not appropriate for the moment, where I was literally feeling that sense of aharon. And there's been a couple moments in my rabbinic career and in my own personal life where the silence came from a silent scream, right? One of the commentators says something so beautiful that I love, which he says that the silence was Aaron screaming so loud. It was like a primal scream and thus sound didn't come out. And I felt that in my own life.
Now, have you been to shivas or other venues like that where someone tries to do what Moses did? In other words, tries to say something to comfort the mourner, and it just totally fails?
Well, if you talk to mourners, their favorite saying to rabbis is, I wish people would stop saying something so stupid to me, like time heals all wounds, or, you know, you'll get through this. I mean, I've lost both my parents very young, and I have my whole slew of stupid things that people have said to me. But I have a lot of compassion for people that come to a shiva house and come to comfort the mourner, because sometimes it is so painfully uncomfortable to sit and watch people you love suffer. And your first instinct is to fix them. That's why I tell people, never go to the people you love when you're truly suffering, because they will be terrible at comforting you, because they don't want to see you suffer. And we see it. Moses says to Aaron, don't you grieve. What is he saying? I don't want you to be in this kind of pain. And I'm going to tell you, you're the leader of the people. You got to model for them not to grieve, which is the opposite of what you would say to someone, right? He's the leader of the people. He should be modeling them that it is okay to grieve. But really, that's about Moses's need not to sit with the discomfort of Aaron's grief. And I think so often people come to the shiva house and they're sitting in the total discomfort of the mourner, and they start chitter-chattering. Time heals all wounds. You'll be okay. Your mother parent is living. I mean, I can throw out a whole slew of pithy comments, but really that's about the person trying to comfort the mourner. That's not about the mourner. And so I tell people, sit, get comfortable with the discomfort of other people's sadness, because that's how you really comfort people.
And just say nothing until the other person initiates.
Yeah. And I have to tell you, I had about 2,000 people see me during Shiva over 7 days when my mother died. I know that sounds like an inordinate number. My mother was an extraordinary, very public person. And I saw people react differently to my discomfort over her death, because it was a very violent, tragic death. She died of brain cancer at a very young age. The people that gave me the most comfort were the ones that could just sit next to me in silence. And one of my favorite experiences from it is someone I didn't know very well came, but I respected her very much in the community. And she came at the end of the shiva. She didn't say a word. People were walking out. She stayed. She stayed until it was just me and her. It had to be 1 a.m. And I looked at her and I realized this is an incredible human. And today she's one of my very best friends. I talk to her almost daily.
And her grace in the moment was just knowing that what you needed was her presence.
Yeah. I just needed her to sit there. I didn't know her that well. I didn't know what I would say to her.
And she was going to stay there.
She was going to sit there as long as I was going to sit there. And I just remembered thinking, this person has a soul that is other. And she's one of my best friends, because right after the year of mourning, I reached out to her and I said, I can't tell you how much that meant to me. And what started was a friendship. And now, you know, 15 years later, we are best of friends. And she's the person that I have that ease with where we can pick up anywhere. We can talk anytime.
Wow.
There's no background needed. And it's because of her soul. And I think about that often.
So, Sherry, what made this person such a sensitive and effective Shiva attendee? Is there a Hebrew word for one who attends a Shiva?
Yes, there is. It's a menuchem, a person who comforts. People that come to the house are comforters. The correct answer, or the political answer, is that she was a rabbi's wife, which is appropriate to this show, right? So she was really practice at it. But I don't think that actually is the answer. I think she had an inner sense that sometimes you are struck damem, literally like Aaron, silent, or dumbfounded, and to realize in that moment that what people need is not your words. They don't even need anything but you to just sit next to them. And the power of sitting next to me during that time, I've learned so much from her because as a rabbi now, I mean, we're talking on a podcast, but I spend a lot less time talking and a lot more time sitting. Probably not a good exercise, but a lot more time sitting. And notice I didn't say listening, because listening, sometimes we're waiting. We're waiting to talk. Sometimes just sitting, literally sitting, the same way I sit to do meditation. I'm not waiting for insight. I'm not waiting to talk. I'm not waiting to know when's the right time to jut in. I'm just sitting. And that's what she did.
Right. Well, wow. Sherry, what a profound lesson. And what an extraordinary way the Torah has of just teaching us how to act in every circumstance. I mean, this whole ritual of mourning and how to comfort the mourner, which you just described so beautifully, is so effective. It was for you personally. It is for so many people you counseled. It's right here in one word in Leviticus 10:3.
Well, that's what I love about this word, because in another interpretation, because there's so many good interpretations, Mark, it comes from the word meaning stone or mineral. And literally, he is cast in stone in that moment. And I really resonate with that because I've seen people almost paralyzed with grief. And I've had that feeling where I literally feel like I'm a stone and the world is moving around me, but I am stuck and paralyzed and fixed. And so in that one word, I think the Torah is capturing so many complicated emotions we have around grief and how it's both internal, external, and it's also otherworldly. Like you're not in the club of grief until you've experienced it. And people say that all the time, like, I'm a rabbi. I've been with people all through my life. And then they have a personal loss and they're like, oh my God, this is horrible. And it's like, yes, because grief is joining a club that you would have never voluntarily entered. And it's devastatingly internal, external, and something else.
Wow. Well, so Sherry, thank you for such a brilliant explication of this passage and really this word in this passage. And the concluding question of the rabbi's husband always goes from one text, the sacred text of the Bible, to another text, which is André Malraux's 1968 book, Anti-Memoir. And he says, I just ran into a man with whom I served in the war, and this man had become a parish priest. So I said to the priest, in all of your years of hearing confessions, what are two things that you've learned about mankind? And the priest said, one, everyone is much less happy than he seems. And two, there's no such thing as a grown-up person. So Sherry, in all your years of being a rabbi, what are two things that you've learned about humankind?
So Mark, I love that teaching because I think we're all adulting. I mean, I'm 52 and I feel like I'm adulting at the same time as my teens and my children right now. And every time they look to me like I know something, or my teenagers think I know nothing, I think to myself, don't you realize I'm adulting? I'm just adulting right now. Give me a break. And the second thing is people aren't as happy as they seem. I think that's a truism, right? I think what we see externally is very different than what people's inner lives are. And I think as a rabbi, you have a real window into people's inner lives. So I love that teaching. What's two things that I've learned along the way? So the two things that I've learned, one is that people have a deep quest to feel like they matter. Hmm. And people know and matter far more than they think they do. And I'm on a quest to make sure everybody that I ever encounter in the world knows that. So it's the reason I get on an elevator and I call it the high philosophy, C-H-A-I, but it's really H-I, which is I get on the elevator, I say hello to everybody, because some people will never be seen or felt they've never been seen through an entire day. And you can imagine the looks I get on an elevator. I mean, people are like, do I know you?
Do you introduce yourself to people with your name and their name?
No, sometimes I do, but always I say, hi, it's so nice to see you today. Hi, I'm glad that you're here today. I'm so glad that you're on our earth today. And literally people look at me like, I'm sorry, do I know you? And I can't tell you how many people say to me, thank you. I needed to hear that. I do another thing called Dignity for a Day, which is we create these packages that every homeless person would need for a day that would give them dignity, from a protein, a vegetable, a fork, a cleaning utensil. But what makes them so special is we write a blessing, a personal note to each of them. And I've given out thousands and thousands and thousands of these bags. There's dog biscuits in there, and there's water because every homeless person has a dog. And I've watched them over and over and over again. Now, people are hungry on the streets. They open the bag. The first thing they do is they take out the water. They take out the dog bone. And as they're setting it up for their animal, which is so Jewish, right? You feed your animals before yourself. They read the note, the first thing. And then they always look up at me and say something like, thank you for seeing me. Thank you for speaking to me. So I feel like the most important thing we need in life is to see people, because everyone truly matters.
Do you think most people know they matter?
No.
Why not?
I think most people feel they're superfluous, that nobody would miss them. And I think it's so painful to feel that and to live that way. And I think that's the majority of people. And I think one of the jobs of people that are caretakers, whether it's a rabbi or a doctor, is to really see people. So that's why it's so important a doctor doesn't say to you, oh, by the way, you have cancer, but to actually say, like, you're a whole entity, a whole human, and I see you. And this piece of you has cancer, but not the totality of you. So I'm very big on that. So that's the first thing I've learned. And if we still have time, the second thing I've learned is that when we experience loss, we can never imagine what it would be like. It's something we can't pre-feel. We never can know loss before we feel it. And once we feel it, we are forever in the after. There's a before of loss and an after of loss. And once you're in the after, it colors your world for the rest of your life. That does not mean that you spend your life grieving. It just means that you live your life with a different sense of urgency. You live your life with a different orientation. You live your life fully knowing that one day you will die. And you don't really know it until you've lost.
Wow. Well, Sherry, thank you, as usual, for such profound and interesting thoughts and ideas, all stemming from this magnificent passage in the Bible and from the wealth of experience that you bring to your teachings and from all your learning that you bring to your experiences. So thank you for being with us today in The Rabbi's Husband.
Thank you, Mark.
All right. Great seeing you. Wow. Well, as usual, Sherry Hirsch is both wise, profound, interesting, and really does what a rabbi should do, does what the ancient rabbis were specifically instructed and trained to do, and what Sherry does so well, which is to bring her textual knowledge to her experiences to her textual knowledge. And today, she brought both of them to The Rabbi's Husband, and I'm just so grateful for her participation and for her friendship, and I encourage everybody to read her books, which are as magnificent as I'm sure all the listeners imagine them to be. Next year in Graceland. I'm Mark Gerson, and this has been The Rabbi's Husband, and thank you for listening. Please go to Apple, to Spotify, to wherever you receive podcasts, rate, review, and subscribe. I can be found at therabbishusband.com or at The Rabbi's Husband on Facebook or Instagram, and I would love to hear from you, so please email me at mark@therabbishusband.com. This podcast is part of the Joshua Network. You can find out more about the Joshua Network at thejoshuanetwork.com. Thank you for listening.